Here we go. Okay. Starting over. And it's working.
Yeah, so we're supposed to be starting now, even though I don't have anything up on the screen, and at least, hopefully, maybe we have audio now. I don't know. But, hey, welcome to The Dividing Line. There we go. Early morning edition. That may not have been wise, but I don't know. I don't know. You know, I just remember some guy years and years ago that was just, you know, always talking about, you know. Anyway, here we are. we have audio and video all at the same time, whether they're synced up or anything, who knows. But here we are. We're early today because I've got an appointment out in East Valley, and then tomorrow we are headed for G3. Hope to be seeing many of you on Thursday and Friday morning. I speak Friday morning. My assigned topic is in reference to Isaiah chapter 6. And so, but I'm one of the first ones up in the morning, 9 a.m. And so you early risers will be able to join me at that time. I don't rate the evening stuff. I'm you know, level C type stuff. So we get the morning stuff when people are chugging their Starbucks to try to stay awake. And the big boys get the nighttime slots. And so. We just go with what we're given, and we're looking forward to seeing y'all there. We do not have a booth this year. I let you ask the person on the other side of the window about that. That's neither here nor there. I'm just not gonna be there all that long because I'm gonna be heading on Friday up to New Hyde Park Baptist Church, and on Saturday and Sunday gonna be speaking there. On New Testament text reliability issues in regards to where the New Testament came from, things like that, at the church there where Doug McMasters is pastor, has been for a number of years now. And I spoke there before Doug did, actually, many, many, many moons ago. So we'll be up there. And so we'll only be at G3 from basically Thursday morning. I guess there's a concert Thursday night. I know I'm supposed to be doing something with the Cross Politic guys. I think Thursday night. Hope it's Thursday night. If it's Wednesday night, oops. And certainly can't be Friday night because I won't be there. But Rich will be there through Friday night. So if it was Friday night for that program, then Rich will do it. That'll Rich, whatever. Who does know how that would turn out? I have no earthly idea. But on Thursday, I'll have a nice Coogee vest on, so I'll be easy to find. But on Friday morning, I have to dress up. So there's absolutely no way on earth Josh Bice would ever allow me to preach in this. Rich says me either. So lots of places on earth that would love me to preach in something like this. But no, we got to go with what we got to go with. Anyways, so I mentioned that one of the things I wanted to do is I wanted to review the recent unbelievable debate. They're not formally debates, but you know what I mean. Between Matt Dillahunty and Glenn Scrivener on can atheism produce a better world? And basically the conclusion was either no or we don't know. Dillahunty's fundamental response was, I don't know. We haven't been given a chance yet, basically. But Matt Dillahunty is definitely one of the more interesting atheists out there speaking. He at times can be your standard in your face type atheist, and there's other times when he manages to hold it in. Dillahunty is a former Christian by his own profession. Obviously, we would dispute that theologically, but be it as it may, and hence falls into that category that it does seem that atheists in general like former Christians because there's that added element to it. In fact, I mentioned, and I think I might have played. If I didn't play it, I had intended to play it. Some of the audience Q&A from the debate. I did play it. The debate that Dillahunty did with Cy Tenbruggenkate, and made reference to a couple times where, quote-unquote, former fellow Christians came up and talked about how their lives are just so much better now that they were atheists. It was an interesting study in apostasy. Anyway, so we wanted to look at what was said for a couple of reasons, and there's two. One was I was just utterly amazed at Matt Dillahunty's summary description of what Christianity actually teaches. Not that, I mean, it was the standard fare for atheists. But when someone claims that they were once a Christian and that they once were thinking about ministry and going into ministry, and then can just completely massacre any type of meaningful summary, and then demonstrate, and this is not unusual at all, and then demonstrate that they do not understand the doctrine of the Trinity. You know, if you were once a meaningful Christian and once had a meaningful understanding of the doctrine of the Trinity, becoming an atheist does not require you to stop having that understanding. And I don't care if it's been 10 years or 15 years. You still should be able to, you know, accurately represent what you once believed. No. That we saw in the debate up in Salt Lake City. The atheists had no idea what the doctrine of the Trinity was. Very easy to misrepresent it. And Matt Dillahunty does the same thing. So we're going to look at what he said. But then, and this is where a lot of folks go, now this is the part you shouldn't do. It's one thing for you to go after the atheist and point out the atheist errors, but why would you engage in a discussion about anything Glenn Scrimner said? Because he did a good job. He, you know, why would you show cracks in the team, in essence? And I suppose I should offer an apologetic as to why it is important to engage in, if you want to call it criticism, comparison, in some way to do what a lot of people just, there are a lot of Christian apologists that simply do not believe that we should have any type of discussion about differing methodologies by criticizing someone when they're doing a debate. Now, I get that because I had a guy last night on Twitter, some young guy. He described himself as a community college dropout. That's how he described himself. And he decided to pop into a thread to accuse me of having some type of unorthodox view of the Trinity, because in a Q&A session in a debate where the discussion was, how do you define the term persons? Someone used a certain phraseology that, well, you call it that, you call it this. You're trying to communicate, and they're like, I'm not going to worry about any of the books that you've written. I'm not going to worry about any of the formal articles or anything else. I'm going to take that one thing, read my idea into it, and accuse you of some type of theological aberration. So you have those types of folks out there that will just pick on anything for any reason whatsoever. I get that. And so when you have folks who have never done a debate, they've never answered a single question and cross-examination. They've never had to. I have a friend, I won't mention him, but he's got an upcoming debate. and he's listening right now, I'm sure. And he wrote to me a couple days ago, and he's trying to write his opening statement. And it's like, how do you get anything meaningful into a 20-minute opening statement? I'm like, I know. There are just so many people who sit out there and watch debates and go, I could have done better than that, who've never even tried. And so, you know, you listen to what those folks have to say, you just sort of smile and go, okay, you know, and you don't want to go, you know, I'd really encourage you to get into debates because you don't want the faith to take that kind of beating. I've seen, you know, I remember when those two poor Baptists debated Keating and Madrid in Denver, and it's just like, oh, it's just painful. Painful to watch. Or when, Jimmy Swaggart. When Jimmy Swaggart debated Ahmed Didot. entertaining, but you don't want to watch it. Anyway, the point being that it's one thing when it would be one thing to criticize what someone's doing if you don't have any experience doing it yourself. It's hopefully useful. And I've had a lot of people found the video we did, for example, where it just so happened that Frank Turk and I have both debated some of the same people, and specifically, in this case, the same atheist, who I don't know is involved in leadership anymore. He got caught up in the Me Too stuff. But anyway, Silverman. And he threw the same question at both of us. And we have very different apologetic methodologies. And so comparing my response to Frank Turk's response was incredibly enlightening to a lot of people. Because here you've got the same atheist, same question. Here's the two different responses. And then when you discuss it and go, and this is why, and this is how theology relates to this, and this is why your theology has to determine your apologetic and so on and so forth. I think that is, while we still have the freedom to do it, extremely important to be doing. And it doesn't mean that I hate Frank Turk. That's what the problem with social media is if you criticize somebody, well, you just hate these people. No, it's not a matter of hating them at all. Yeah, but if you say something bad about them, well, part of me wants to go, have you ever Googled my name? I get bad stuff said about me every few seconds on the web. That's just how it is. But it is, I think, vitally important. I mean, if you want to see how it ends up going the wrong way, look at what's going on in the Southern Baptist Convention, where you can't question anybody. You can't say anything against a fellow Southern Baptist. Man, I ran into the 11th commandment in 2004 and got run over by a bus. I wasn't even in the Southern Baptist Convention, but I was teaching for a Southern Baptist school. And so got run over by a bus for daring to question somebody who's now a Lutheran, I think, and appropriately so. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. The fact is that seeing multiple perspectives. Can I use a quick sports analogy? For some people just find sports analogies to be helpful. Then I'll use a theological analogy. The Tour de France is the greatest bike race in the world. Giro d'Italia, Vuelta a España are almost as good. But look, the Tour is the Tour. And so probably the most iconic stage in the Tour de France is L'Alpe d'Huez. 22 corners, switch back up this mountainside. That when they do it, and I'm not sure if they're doing it this year or not, I haven't looked yet, you'll have over 1 million people line that route for more than a week beforehand. I mean, it's crazy. It's insane. And the tour has been won. People have built the foundation for having won by winning L'Alpe d'Huez. So when you look at how people have won that particular stage, there are people who've gone on solo attacks. There are people who've gone from the breakaway. There are people who've waited in the peloton and then caught the poor guy, 100 meters from the end. And you can, by comparing, you don't just look at one video. You don't just look at who won last time. You go back as far back as you can. And you compare all of the methodologies and all the planning and where the stage was in the course of the race and what the weather conditions were, and you look at everything, and you're going to find all sorts of different ways that people have won, and you're going to learn something from looking at all those different ways. And so just on a sports analogy basis, it's good to have comparisons of how you approach things. Theologically speaking, what we learn and what we hopefully will learn today is that the theology you bring into a discussion like this should, and I think it did, and so at least on that level, I think it's appropriate that Glenn Scrivener responded the way that he did, but your answers will reflect your fundamental theology. And as a God-centered theology conflicts with a very man-centered culture more and more and more and more, and I mean, this is happening very rapidly, there is great pressure to adopt theological positions that are more defensible or do not hand the atheist or the critic or the skeptic or whatever, whoever you're debating, does not hand them more bombs to throw your direction, more weapons to use. There are many people involved in apologetics, whether they've thought it through or not, that fundamentally function upon the idea that you need to minimize what the enemy can throw at you. Now, there is an appropriate utilization of that thinking, and that is you need to have a decent debate topic that's specific enough that you can, sort of force the conversation to remain in some manageable spectrum. That's not always possible. It doesn't always happen. But more to the point, when you have cross-examination and have less formal and more open discussion like this was. It wasn't a formal debate, obviously. Your theological presuppositions should come out and should be clearly seen. And the problem is there are certain biblical realities that people in our society find to be extremely problematic. And we need to realize that, I mean, we are in the day right now. We already know this, where the Bible's teaching on sexual morality is considered to be hateful. And so what are you trying to do as an apologist? Who are you trying to impress? What's your final goal? If your goal is to score points with as many people as possible within your audience, there are certain fundamental Christian beliefs that you're going to have to diminish minimally or deny otherwise to get people to like what it is you have to say. Obviously, I believe we are utterly dependent upon the Holy Spirit of God to restrain the rebellion that exists within the hearts of men and draw men to his truth. You don't diminish the truth in the process. That'll sort of come up in an extremely, extremely, extremely controversial aspect of the conversation that happened. But let me just, before we start that, once again, there's a great deal of discussion pretty much every day on Facebook and other places as to what anyone means when you talk about presuppositional apologetics. And I think as we listen to the conversation, this is going to come back up. When I talk about presuppositional apologetics, I'm simply talking about that apologetics that takes seriously the biblical revelation that God has revealed himself, that the basis of our knowledge of anything is found first and foremost in our acknowledgement of God. And that therefore, there we must have a biblical doctrine of God, a biblical doctrine of man, and that if we have a biblical doctrine of God and a biblical doctrine of man, that is going to provide us with a solid foundation for understanding the laws of logic, rationality, but that I must continue to function as a Christian in doing apologetics. I cannot, I dare not, I am not allowed to cease being under the lordship of Christ when I begin to reason with the unbeliever. There is no neutral ground upon which we can stand, because anything that exists, exists because Jesus Christ made it. If it's a fact, Jesus Christ made it a fact, and Jesus Christ defines it. And so I cannot abandon the lordship of Christ to then attempt to establish the lordship of Christ. So I do not believe that a non-Reformed individual can consistently be a presuppositionalist. I don't, because part of presuppositionalism is a recognition of the fundamental rebellion of man against the knowledge of God, the suppression of the knowledge of God. And so I just point out that, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, the word of the cross is indeed to those who are perishing foolishness, but to those who are being saved, to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. You have a message of the cross, which contains particular historical and theological assertions and facts. The death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, fulfilled prophecy in his coming, the reasons of his coming, et cetera, et cetera. And so the message of the cross is indeed to those who are perishing foolishness. So there is a description of an individual, individuals, plural, as those who are perishing, in contrast, those who are being saved. Now, the text is going to say, and which one you are is up to God. So there is a very strong Reformed element in what is said here. But the point is that it's the same message. And the conclusion for the one, foolishness. The conclusion for the other, power of God. And it is what state you are in that determines how you're going to interpret this. You cannot alter the logos tou staru, the message of the cross, so as to make it the power of God to those who are perishing. You can't do that. If you try to do that, it's no longer the message of the cross. And so the point is, it is a fundamental biblical reality brought out later on by Paul in the same text, where he's saying, you know, the Jews, they're seeking signs, the Greeks seeking wisdom, but to those who are called by God, to the elect, Christ, the power of God, Christ, the wisdom of God, so on and so forth. It is a fundamental necessity to recognize the work, the necessity of the work of the Spirit of God, and that the Spirit of God can actually accomplish what God intends to accomplish in that situation. Not that we're not talking here some marshmallow prevenient grace stuff. We're talking about the grace of God that actually grants spiritual life, insight, takes out a heart of stone, gives a heart of flesh. The only heart that's ever going to love God is the heart of flesh, not the heart of stone. And in the same way, in Romans chapter 1, you have this exchanging. The exchanging, you know, they profess themselves to be wise, they became fools. Their foolish hearts were darkened. The very seat of what makes man, man, loses that natural light of revelation when a person is in sin. And it is not until there is that fundamental change that that light can then function as that light is intended to function, and will function in that fashion. So the point is that at key elements in New Testament revelation concerning the nature of the fallen man, you have biblical teaching. You have direct biblical teaching of the necessity of the work of the Spirit because of a fundamental problem in the person who is fallen. And this must, therefore, impact apologetics. When you don't have that underlying theology, and that is not the majority theology, never has been. Why has it never happened? Because it is utterly destructive of human pride. It's utterly destructive of human pride. God's the one who saves. We can't save ourselves. We can't save somebody else. We're totally dependent upon God. We are used of him. We are called to be the ones that proclaim his message. And we should have a boldness to do so. But it is foolishness to think that I can trick somebody into doing the right thing, that I can trick someone into making the right decision. And so when you have that understanding, it's going to fundamentally impact how you do apologetics. You are going to be looking at the presuppositions that are created by the rebel sinner that fundamentally make it impossible for the claims of Christ to be real to that person. And you're going to focus upon that, and you're going to pray that God will use you. All the arguments in the world aren't going to change that person's position because they are not a neutral moral agent, or a moral neutral agent, either one. Their reasoning has been fundamentally impacted. And as long as they are perishing, that message will remain to them foolishness. And the only one that can stop them from perishing is the giver of life. So apologetics has to be done in the hopes of God's self-glorification in the salvation of his people. Also recognizing that apologetics has the function of edifying the saints, building the saints up in their faith. And both the proclamation of the message and apologetics has another function that most people don't even want to think about, and that is increasing the judgment of the rebellious. Again, I don't even want to hear that. I'm going to tune you out now. But the fact of the matter is that when you have that level of light being given to someone, why did Jesus go to Bethsaida? Why did he go to Chorazin? Why did he go? Why did he go to places where they want to throw him off of a cliff? Were there people saved there? Well, in God's sovereignty, yes. But the reality is that Jesus said that if Sodom and Gomorrah, which were watchwords for the most evil people in ancient history, amongst the Jewish people anyways, if Sodom and Gomorrah had had the light that Chorazin and Bethsaida had, they would have repented long ago. That's not some dumb middle knowledge argument. It's making a point. And the point is, if you can see God's justice in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, how much more should you see God's justice in the destruction of Chorazin and Bethsaida? The Son of God walked amongst them. The Son of God taught the truth amongst them. And they didn't care. Now, you say, but God could have changed their hearts. Yes, he could have. So there is a purpose why God is demonstrating the sovereignty of his grace and the salvation of a specific people. And there will not be a single mouth that will open to argue that God was unjust to judge anyone that he judges. Because when the books are opened, all the motivations of the heart will be seen. And once again, question I've asked many times before, Romans chapter 9. What if God, willing in patience to deal with vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, for what purpose? For the demonstration of his power. And if you can look into your heart and honestly say, I want to see God's power glorified. I want to see his holiness known. I want to see his justice done along with his mercy and his love and his grace. There are not many people who can honestly look in their hearts and say, I want to see God's power displayed. When they do say that, it's to give me a Cadillac or a Lexus or something. That's not what we're talking about. The power there is God's power in the judgment of sinners. In Romans 9, the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction. Yeah, it's right there in the text. Okay, so with that, let's take a listen. Ooh, 1.6. No, that's not going to work. They were talking fast enough as it was. that would not work at all. All right. This is from the Unbelievable broadcast. I think it was last week. And this is Matt Dillahunty, Glenn Scrivener. And let's just dive in here.
Really fallacious reasoning. Except that Christianity is about God the human. I mean, foundationally, Christianity is Christ. It's foundationally, God the Son has become God our brother. We've just celebrated Christmas. It's the time at which the Word became flesh, which is just a stunning religious idea that is found nowhere else. Disgusting to my Muslim friends. You know, it's disgusting true. To the Greco-Roman minds. And yet, the Christian claim uniquely is that God took flesh and even became a single cell in Mary's womb, became the weak and despised thing for the sake of all weak and despised things. And I think from there you get the principle that humanity in and of itself has a dignity because God has so dignified it. Otherwise, it's us elevating humanity to a certain, you know, position. Why should we elevate humanity to a certain position? Why should there be such a thing as human exceptionalism?
Why shouldn't there be?
Is that just a power play, right?
I mean, I'm not just asking that to, like,
yep,
you know.
Do you have an answer? Like, what do you think about human exceptionalism?
I don't really see any reason why it shouldn't.
Okay, so that's Glenn Scrivener speaking, and There is everything good in talking about the condescension of God, incarnation, God choosing the weak things of the world rather than the things that are mighty. All of that is true, but I think it has its deepest reality in the fact that God is demonstrating his power, his glory, and his majesty in the redemption of an undeserving people. If you start with the people first, then what the primary purpose is becomes secondary. So I think you need to start with the primary. And someone might say, with an atheist, that's not going to work. Well, no, you still speak the truth. Let the atheist deny the truth if you want. But the reality is that the primary purpose is God's self-glorification, and the mechanism that he uses to bring that about involves the incarnation, outpouring of the Holy Spirit, divine actions in the salvation of a particular people. And so when you take the last section there and make it central, and then you have to go back and try to add the actual important stuff on later on, I'm not sure the foundation is really solid. So I would simply say that. Now Dillahunty is responding. Let me pull this back here.
Yep. You know, do you have an answer? Like, what do you think about human exceptionalism?
I don't really see any reason why it shouldn't be. Well, of course we're going to be concerned about our own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about, yeah, there's...
Is that
there's
moral, though? Or is that just a power play?
So this is the thing when we talk about what is moral. Mm. So quite often they'll say, well, the thing you're describing, that's all well and good, but it's not morality. Fine, then I don't care about morality. You need to tell me what you're going to... Because if the only thing you're going to count is morality, is some sort of, you know, divine command or a supernatural being that serves as a grounding for whatever you want to do. That's not what I think anybody's ever really cared about for morality. When we talk about morals.
Now, of course, you know, as soon as you listen to atheists reasoning about morality, it is always so frustrating because you can never get past the shoelaces. It can never get off the ground because it's just me. And it's one cosmic accident fizzing one way, talking to other cosmic accidents that are fizzing another way. And it's never going to get any farther than that. You can get a bunch of people to fizz the same direction if you want. But if the next generation decides to fizz otherwise, then that's the good fizz now. I mean, they're just they're the need for an objective, universal ground is built into us. We recognize that this accidental fizzing stuff is never going to get anywhere. Now, why is that? Because we live in a world that tells us that that's not going to get us anywhere.
When we talk about this, we're evaluating the consequences of our actions with respect to some goal, and does it ultimately increase, decrease, or have no effect on our well-being? Which is why I think Sam went with well-being. I didn't used to use that. I used a different language when I did my
talk. But you fundamentally agree with Sam Harris that that's something we can objectively measure.
Okay, so this is the Sam Harris well-being of human beings as the ultimate moral guide stuff. And of course, I don't want to get into it right now, but who gets to define that? And we're seeing with how rapidly these definitions are changing today that this is quicksand. I mean, I saw a video yesterday of this guy in Canada who pretends he's a woman and who tries to get poor women to wax his male parts. And files lawsuits, and it's just a complete deviant attacking a guy. This reporter comes up to him after a thing, and after some, because he's the guy's in court all the time, because he's constantly filing suit against this, that, and the other. And the guy attacks the reporter. We're looking at this kind of the society is saying that the rest of us have to celebrate this level of confusion and insanity. The library cross-dressing drag queen insanity evil that is just, and the society is saying, no, this is good for our well-being. You've got to have a standard that is meaningful. And again, atheism can't get above its own shoelaces. With something, it just can't go there.
Through, say, scientific means, as long as we know what benefits, what generally humans want in their lives.
I think you can do objective assessments, objective evaluations with respect to a standard.
As far as you're concerned.
You don't have an objective reason why you care about that standard, just like you don't have an objective reason why you care about a God. If there was a God, he should come along and kind of clarify all this. I would think that would be a duty. But the beautiful story that you're talking about where...
Okay, now here's where... You know, up to this point, you know, he's talking about morality and all the rest of stuff. And now you can tell he's been wanting to say this for a while, and here it comes.
You know, the most powerful being comes down and becomes a cell, becomes one of the weak, one of the fallen in order to save them. That's an incredibly nice way to package it, but that's, I have, I guess, a completely different take on it, because the story is a little different. The story starts in Genesis where God creates everybody, and then it all screws up. And then he tries to fix it, and it screws up. And he tries to fix it, and it screws up. It's this parade. It's this comedy of errors. And then you get to a spot where...
Okay, so you do wonder what his church background was. I don't know. I suppose it's out there someplace. I'm sure there's somebody out there that has what church he went to or whatever. I don't know. But there... I guess there are people who sort of present the Christian faith in that way, that, you know, God made it good and wonderful, and all of a sudden it screws up, and so he tries to fix it, and it screws up again, and he tries to fix it again. So he's probably talking about the flood and stuff like that. And so if you do have the idea of an open theism, process theology, or some really strange forms of dispensationalism, where God's trying to do one thing, plan A didn't work, plan B, plan C, then yeah, okay. That's certain. None of those, of course, reflect any type of historical understanding of Scripture or anything along those lines. They're very strange and weird, but yeah.
God, who's been demanding that we slaughter animals and burn them because he likes barbecue, is now decided that he's going to come down and take human form.
Because he likes barbecue. He's going to mention it before. He's going to mention it again. The sweet, sweet smelling aroma. God loves the smell of burning flesh, is how he's going to put it. And again, did he really believe that when he was a Christian? Did he really think that it was the specific smell, or was it the obedience of his people in doing what he commanded them to do, and the recognition of their sin, and the thanksgiving for the provision of a means of having peace with the Holy God? And why the surface? Why is it that so many atheists default to the most absurd literalism? I mean, there are some absurd literalists. That Rager guy, the IFB preacher guy. Okay, but they are a very, very small number of people. And I don't get the feeling that he came out of a group like that. Maybe I could be wrong, I guess. But whatever it is they're responding to, they're not responding to anything that's had serious impact for centuries thereafter. They're not responding to an Augustine, not responding to a Calvin, they're not responding to people like that. But did he really believe that, you know, God likes barbecue? Is that really where he's going to go with that? I don't know.
Is now decided that he's going to come down and take human form and sacrifice himself to himself for a weekend to fix everything for everybody.
Now, there... Do you get the feeling that this is not the first time that Matt Dillahunty has said that? I get the feeling that this is a fairly well-worn phrase, that he's going to come down and sacrifice himself to himself. Now, this is where, and this is going to, you know, Glenn's going to push back on this, and I get the feeling that at least at this point, that is what Matt thinks this is. He does not understand the relationship of Father, Son, and Spirit. He does not understand that there is a relationship that exists between the divine persons, that Jesus, for example, in John chapter 17, specifically makes reference to that time before the world began, when he was glorious in the presence of the Father. So there is a relationship, proston theon, John 1:1b. It almost sounds like Dillahunty has a modalistic understanding of the Trinity. But without having been a part of a specifically modalistic denomination. So in other words, he'd be a lot like a lot of evangelicals who also are modalistic in their understanding of the Trinity, simply out of ignorance and not out of confession. Which, by the way, take a look. Canon Press is supposed to be dropping the Sweater Vest Dialogues number 2, which is on the doctrine of the Trinity. And it was supposed to be released this morning sometime, so I'm not sure if it's... because it's only 8-something in Idaho right now. So, yeah, I was going to say it may not be up yet, but let me know if you track it down. Let people know if that... It is coming out today, so take a look at it. Look for it one way or the other.
That's blood magic. That is sacrificial blood magic thinking and nothing to do about human value.
Blood magic, sacrificial blood magic thinking with nothing to do with human value. Well, if you have made it your primary argument that God's first priority is human value, rather than God's first priority is his self-glorification, and because he's our creator and has chosen to glorify himself through the creation of mankind and the redemption of particular people, therefore, there is a grounding for man's value demonstrated in the cross. See the importance from my perspective of where you start. You gotta start the main things, the plain things. Really, really, really important.
Who actually believes that? What you just described as a human value. Who actually believes that? What you just described as a summary of Christianity? Who actually believes?
How could you not?
This was a video, and I didn't watch the video. I've only listened to it. I converted it to audio so I could listen to it. But I would, when I saw the video, I was like, I've never seen Justin looking like that. He was wearing these glasses. And he said at the beginning, he lost contact lens. And so he's looking very scholarly in his glasses. And so he would have looked a little bit different than that. But I know Justin well enough. I've been in studio with him many, many times. I'm going to have to go back and look at the video and see how he was looking at Matt when he was giving that summary. Because, you know, I fully understand Scrivener sitting there going, who believes that? What? Where did you just come up with that from? I mean, and his response, well, who couldn't? It's like, wow.
Wait, did God come down and become human, sacrifice himself?
God the Son became God our brother.
He's still God.
God the Son.
Sometimes it's, thankfully, in this situation, you have a British accent versus an American accent, so you can figure out who's saying what. So Glenn has said, you know, God the Son has become God our brother. Now, has entered into human flesh for the purpose of the redemption of God's people. But did you hear Dillahunty? Listen to what Dillahunty says here.
Oh, God the Son became God our brother.
He's still God.
God the Son.
He's still God. Well, so do you hear the Unitarianism in Dillahunty's assumption? He's not functioning as a Trinitarian, or at least as someone who ever was, or even understands the doctrine of the Trinity.
Okay, God our brother, right? But son, the son.
Are you a non-Trinitarian? Sorry.
See, are you a non-Trinitarian? He's thinking that modalistic Unitarianism is the Trinity. I mean, If Matt Dillahunty's understanding of the Trinity is not modalistic, then I don't understand what he's saying here. I don't understand what he said before. I don't understand what he's saying now. I don't understand how he's responding to Scrivener. It just seems to me very, very plain. This man never understood Nicaea. He never understood the Athanasian Creed. He never understood any of the... Because my recollection is he was some sort of a Protestant. So any of the statements of faith, Westminster, anything that came from that, Three Forms Unity, whatever, he wasn't Trinitarian. And I don't see anything in atheism that would require you to automatically lose your understanding of what you supposedly once believed. I don't get that either.
That's precisely because I'm Trinitarian. God the Son,
right,
became God our brother, full of the Holy Spirit.
Okay.
In order to unite us as family back to the same source, back to the Father.
So, how would I have responded to that? I would have said the second person of the Divine Trinity, the Son, took on human flesh. To use the specific. You know, look at the Baptist Catechism. It does a great job I think it's 23, 24, one of the questions. The fullness of human nature, not in a fallen state, without sin, but not just a body either. And the incarnation is real. It's the Son who became incarnate, not the Father, not the Spirit, for the purpose of functioning as the Redeemer of God's people, prophet, priest, and king, to the glory of the triune God, because that's sort of how the early church summarized it in Philippians chapter 2. I mean, if that is a fragment of an early hymn, and I think that it is, in Philippians 2, 5 through 11, the focus is not upon us. The focus is upon God, to the glory of God the Father. So there's already been an establishment in the mechanism before this that Glenn Scrivener has laid out, that the focus is upon mankind. And I think that leads to having to deal with things from a different perspective. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. This is basic Trinitarian theology.
Did God not sacrifice himself?
Did God not sacrifice himself? Again, who is the functional Unitarian here? Who is functioning upon the assumption of Unitarianism? He does not seem to recognize the distinction between the divine persons. He does not seem to recognize that it was not the Father who became incarnate. It was not the Spirit who became incarnate. It was the Son who became incarnate. It's just a part of his thinking.
The Father sent the Son.
But they're the same.
But they're the same. Modalistic Unitarianism. And if someone, you know, I've got Twitter up here. If someone out there knows what church Matt Dillahunty came from, if you could tweet that for me, or if you could look it up, Rich, if I don't know if it's out there, it may take too long to find it. But I would think I would remember, but it doesn't necessarily, because I don't remember reading anything specifically about Matt Dillahunty's past. Southern Baptist. Well, I've met more than one modalistic Southern Baptist. 25 years, Southern Baptist. That's what Rich is telling me. Well, the Baptist faith and message is plainly Trinitarian, but. Remember when a oneness group, or at least with oneness people in it, Phillips, Craig, and Dean, sang for the Southern Baptist Convention? One of the things we pointed out at the time is that the Baptist Faith and Message 2000 does not contain enough specificity on the doctrine of the Trinity to detect modalism, at least the modern UPCI version of modalism. And what I mean by that is the statement made by the Baptist Faith and Message does not emphasize the pre-existent, the eternal pre-existence of the divine persons in such a way as to force a modalist to go, I can't sign that. It's mushy enough to be squeezed into a modalistic understanding. It's not what they intended. That is not an appropriate use of it. By any stretch of the imagination, they intended to define the doctrine of the Trinity appropriately. But the fact is that that is the one area of the doctrine of the Trinity that most evangelicals struggle to express. And as a result, the Baptist Faith and Message does not clearly state that. If you were to read any commentaries on it, if you were to read anybody who worked on it, you could come to a proper understanding. They're not modalists. They're not promoting modalism. It's not consistent with modalism. But the point is that as it is stated, it does not, with sufficient clarity, define that particular issue. So Southern Baptist, huh? Well, that okay. Yeah, that fits. That fits.
The Father sent the Son.
But they're the same.
They're not the same.
They're part of the Trinity.
Yeah, they are. Definitely
they are one, right?
They are definitely part of the Trinity.
Are they one, though?
They're united, absolutely. The Father, Son, and Spirit.
United. I mean, we're united at a table, but we're not
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he is plainly, unquestionably promoting a modalistic understanding of the Trinity. So the fact of the matter is Matt Dillahunty was a heretic as a Christian and is a heretic as an atheist. And something tells me that if someone were to point this out to him, he'd go, okay, I don't think anybody really knows. But he might go, but hey, yeah, maybe I have to do some reading and figure out what the actual historical doctrine is. If he were to, in a non-mocking fashion, in a way that actually seeks to try to understand, if he were to read the Athanasian Creed, you cannot read the Athanasian Creed and come up with this. It is specifically designed to make sure you can't come up with a Unitarian modalistic understanding of the doctrine of the Trinity. But whether he's ever done that or not, I don't know.
The Father is in the Son, and the Son is in the Father, so that they are united on a level that is far superior to ours.
The Father is in the Son, and the Son is in the Father. I'm not sure that was the best response. Why not just simply say there is one being of God, shared by three divine persons, fully by three divine persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. The being of God cannot be divided into parts and pieces. Somewhere along the way, you've got to define for him the difference between being and person. There's no way to discuss the doctrine of the Trinity as long as you're stuck with the 1 + 1 + 1 = 3 and also equals 1 stuff. You have to be able to make the distinction that is necessary to be made in understanding what the doctrine of the Trinity is. I know you don't want to, when the thing drops that Doug Wilson and I did last week, this morning sometime, we spent a lot of time talking about what they call the opera ad intra and the opera ad extra, the internal operations and external operations of the Trinity. And we're talking about how you recognize Father, Son, and Spirit. And it's easy when it comes to the roles they've taken in the redemption of mankind. In the economy of salvation, it's easy to distinguish between Father, Son, and Spirit there. But how do you do that before eternity? As they exist in perfect harmony and love and unity with one knowledge for the confused people out there, or the people who just don't like me and just want to misrepresent me, how do you distinguish? Because that's where the argument in regards to patriarchy, ESS, eternal subordination of the Son, that's what we're talking about. It gets into the weeds, but it has to. How do you distinguish between them? I realize getting into all that stuff with an atheist, unbelievable, when you're supposed to be talking about can atheism ground. Okay, I get it. But there are effective ways to say what we're talking about is one being of God. And person and being are not the same thing. There is a way to do that.
But why does there need to be a blood sacrifice?
Well, because to walk away from God, to be disconnected from life.
Did anyone else, as soon as you heard that, go, well, that's interesting. The first two questions that Dr. Cotty asked me in the mosque in Memphis, we don't understand the Trinity, explain that to us. And why did a part of God have to die? First two questions, and there you have, yeah.
To walk away from God, to be disconnected from life, means death, right? And in the Bible, the life is in the blood.
Well, who made that rule?
It's the nature of the case, don't you think? If God is life, God is a source
of
life.
No, God made that rule by his creative decree. So the universe in which we live, that he placed us in for his glory and his purposes, establishes this reality. And you as an atheist don't have any reality, any counter-reality to even offer other than utter randomness and chaos. So,
differently?
Well, if God is the source of life and we reject life, what does that leave us with? Death. If God wants to unite with us in our death, what will he have to take on? Our death.
So you're talking, first of all, you're speaking kind of metaphorically here, because I'm not rejecting life. I'm rejecting a proposition that there's some eternal life because I don't see sufficient evidence for it. If there is, cool. Mm-hmm. But.
Because I don't see sufficient evidence. But, hey, if there is, cool. What a worldview. It has been interesting over the past 30 years or more, almost 40 years now, to be watching the evolution of atheism. I remember when George Smith's book came out and you started hearing atheists saying, well, atheism is not really a rejection of the existence of God. It's just more, you don't have evidence. You know, they were doing the same thing that we do. I don't do, but people do on our side. Smaller target. You know, less, let's say less, so we have to prove less. So we can win debates is basically what that was all about.
God, this notion, why does there need to be a blood sacrifice at all? At some point we were running around killing animals and doing it because God loved the smell of burning flesh. Literally, it says that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while it's, I think I know what part of the objection is. It's like the Easter story when atheists will say, and then the zombies rose up and marched on Jerusalem, and people will be like, there's nothing in the Bible about zombies. But it does talk about the dead getting up out of the graves and going in there.
Sadly, it's more often Christians questioning the reality of that story than it is atheists. Sadly, but that's, and we've talked about that before. It's the Matthew section that Lycona and others consider to be metaphorical or something like that.
And so it's a colloquialism to refer to it as zombies. I don't think even the atheists, by and large, are thinking that we're talking Walking Dead here. But it's a shorthand to show that there's...
I think there's some Christians that think it's Walking Dead.
Something that's potentially absurd here, an extraordinary claim that doesn't have evidence for it. This isn't even that. This isn't even an extraordinary claim that doesn't have evidence for it. This is, to me, bizarre. What is it about killing something that God needs you to do in order for God to forgive you?
Okay, now, what's the answer to this? The Old Testament sacrificial system is pointing us toward the fulfillment in Jesus Christ. The life is in the blood. Life has been forfeited by rebellion, and God is going to provide the lamb. And he gives us numerous pictures so that when he actually does it, we've got the background to understand it. There has to be this overarching purpose that God has. And it can't just be focused upon us. It has to be something that is grander than that. So the theology that can answer this is an overarching theology that includes the very sovereign decree of God. And it can't open theisms out. Process theology doesn't even get to the start line. All that stuff laid to the side.
If God is the creator of everything, including the rules of how all this works, couldn't he have come up with rules that don't involve killing things?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first of all, the priest was many other things, but he was also your butcher, right? You would eat the lamb after you sacrificed it. You would eat the bull. You know,
What if you didn't? Would it change anything? No, wouldn't change anything at all. What if you just gave it all to the priest, but you didn't get any of it yourself? Would that change anything fundamentally? No.
We go to the butcher. We still sacrifice our animals, and in that sacrifice, even today, in a very secular sense, the death of that animal means our life. In that very literal sense, okay, that animal dies so that we might live. And it's just that in the Old Testament, it was also teaching a spiritual dimension. on top of the barbecues that we all love. You're from Texas, I'm from Australia, we love barbecues, okay?
The vegans are going to hate us.
It was a great conversation with Cosmic Skeptic, by the way. On top of that butchery, there was also a spiritual lesson being taught, and the spiritual lesson being taught was not that the blood of this bull is paying for your sin, but that there is a Messiah who is coming who will pay for your sins. Because, no, the blood of goats and bulls cannot pay for sin, but God can take responsibility for his handiwork, and God did take responsibility for his handiwork, and it was his death that actually paid for sin.
Okay, got around to it eventually. I have to skip ahead. And I'm going to pick up to 1.2 because we're run short on time, and I don't want to have to bail out on this or just treat it very, very surface level way.
Except for this. I did a debate in a Church of Christ where I told him I could write a better book than the Bible and I could prove it to him. Because I could rewrite it word for word, reverse its position on slavery, and it would be a better book. Because for the people who are looking at this, not so much as metaphorical lessons or like that, if they're looking at this as an instruction book for life, that book advocates slavery. That's not even a question. If you were to say, thou shalt not own a human being as property, that would be better than saying you can and that you can pass them on. And so this was the example I used for the people who are kind of like Bible worshippers, not the people who go in looking for, hey, there's an interesting message here, or they're going to tell me something about my life, but no, this is literally word for word, blah, you know. That type of mindset,
which was Jesus's mindset about Scripture,
is probably more responsible for the harm and damage that a lot of us would lay at the foot of Christianity than Glenn's version, for sure. Okay. I mean, I don't think Glenn's pro-slavery at all. And when you start looking at things where you are finding a way to take a message that could easily be viewed as this is a blood magic sacrifice and say, well, life has to consume life to exist, and you want to kind of maybe blow off why God would have made it that way or why it had to be made that way, which is a weird and interesting theological discussion. Getting rid of those things and keeping the good parts is all I've advocated for ever. And secular humanism, to me, is taking the good parts, whether they're found in Christianity, Judaism, Scientology.
And who's deciding on, in a sense, and the good is simply defined by what you regard as the measure of human well-being, and anything that basically points us in that direction.
And it's not fully defined or anything else. But to pretend that we don't have some beginning understanding of it, I think it's a bit ridiculous.
Okay. So, I think very briefly, in a sense, that Matt is sketching out this idea that there is a secular morality.
Well, there's an example that came along with this that Glenn produced when he was listing off societal health versus religiosity and teeing me up for the Gregory S. Paul thing. Mm. He mentioned divorce rates. But that comes with the presumption that divorce is a bad thing.
Sure.
And I don't believe that. I'm recently divorced. Me and my ex-wife are as good friends now as we ever were, and better. And we're both in agreement that it was absolutely the right thing for us to do. And so what's happened here is, from my perspective, and obviously people can disagree, religious thinking, religious teaching, religious dogma has done a number of great disservices to human beings by setting up a notion of a soulmate, by setting up the notion that marriage needs to be one man, one woman forever. That's caused countless problems. By setting up a view of death that does not allow people to deal with that. If we started with the notion that death is the eventual consequence of life, it would fundamentally change, and that was the end as far as we knew, and anything else would be a bonus. It would fundamentally change, I think, how we treated people while they were still alive. And so there's a number of problems here that are rooted in the theology, rooted in the notion that there's a God, which I think if you set those aside and just focus on the things that actually directly try to benefit human beings, it has to be better.
So it's all the benefits of Christianity plus a few more because you haven't got some of the baggage, essentially.
Well, you know, I mean, Matt said that he could write a Bible that's superior to the Bible by reversing its position on slavery. I think if you started from scratch without the Bible, though, I don't think you, and I don't think anyone has, written a book or a series of books or a collection of books, a library of books, that has done what the Bible has done for slavery in the world. Because slavery is a human universal, and it has not been overturned by anyone other than those who took the Bible seriously back in the 18th century. They were evangelical Christians, they were Quakers, they were people who took the Bible seriously. So
parts of it seriously.
It's a longer discussion about how you take the Old Testament, but...
Okay, so it's a long discussion about how you take the Old Testament. Did any of you see the... discussion, I saw just some portions of it. I didn't follow any of the threads. But day before yesterday. I know it was continued yesterday. So I think it was the day before yesterday. There was a statement made about the American form of incarceration being a form of slavery. And pretty hard to argue against that when you put someone in chains in a cage for a lengthy period of time. That is a form of slavery. The freedom's gone. In fact, it's in many ways, it's worse than the old form of slavery, because back then you couldn't leave the plantation, but you had a wife and you had kids and you know, your family, and you know, you could walk in the fields and stuff like that. And instead of being in solitary confinement or stuck with a bunch of other guys in a cell block someplace. And a lot of people have made the point that there really isn't a meaningful biblical foundation for mere incarceration as being an issue of justice. Under biblical law, if you stole from somebody, you had to pay back with reparation what you stole. And so the idea would be, if you do something to someone, then you have to repay. You have to not be losing your liberty doesn't do anything for the victim. And so there was a discussion going on as what is more biblical, because there are numerous forms of slavery in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Now, in the New Testament, you don't have laws establishing forms of slavery. You have exhortations to those who are already in a culture, which every culture up to that point in time had forms of slavery of one kind or another. I suppose you could find exceptions somewhere, but Assyria, Babylon, Greece, Rome, this was the context. And so in the New Testament, you have exhortations, if you are a slave, do not rebel against your master, but seek your own freedom. It is better to be free. So if you can bring that freedom about, as there were people in the narrative of the New Testament who had accomplished that. But in the Old Testament, you have different kinds. You have voluntary slavery. Sounds weird, isn't it? But that's because it was an economic thing. And then you have the issues of war. And what people don't understand, and I, again, went over this in the Holiness Code series a number of years ago, but a lot of people, even the vast majority of my friends haven't listened to all that, and I fully understand why. But the reality is that, and Dillahunty doesn't understand this, and I would not hold an atheist accountable to accurately representing the Bible at this point anyways, because I just wouldn't expect it. If you can't accurately represent the doctrine of the Trinity, I hardly expect you to accurately represent this either. But when someone says that, well, the Bible just simply could have said this and stopped all of it, what they're not understanding is that what that would mean, especially in the war context, was that you'd be raising the black flag. Do you know what raising the black flag means? In Western war, to raise the black flag meant you're not taking prisoners. You all wounded, all who try to surrender will be killed. Why do I say that? It's real simple. What slavery allowed in war situations was for life to continue. Because when you destroyed the men of a culture and the crops and the houses, what are you going to do with the women and the children? They're not going to be able to survive. You're talking subsistence level existence at this time. There wasn't any Red Cross, which is was founded by Christians. There wasn't any Red Cross to come in and provide food and water. If in a war situation, you wiped out the men, and you wiped out the crops in the process, they're going to die. They're going to starve to death. They're either going to be eaten by wild animals or they're going to starve to death. So when people complain about the slavery situation, well, it's just, you know, it was the mechanism for the preservation of innocent life. So you had the war situation, and then you had the economic situation where if, you know, there were droughts and diseases and all sorts of things that would happen, that even if you worked extremely hard, might put yourself in a position where you could no longer provide for your family. The law allowed for indentured servitude, as we would call it, or slavery, where you could sell yourself and your family to someone so that they might live. And here's the issue. We are so individualistic in Western society that we're with Patrick Henry. Give me liberty or give me death. That's not a biblical concept. There were... Paul writes to the Christians, and he writes to slaves, and he writes to those who are not going to be able to bring about their freedom, and says, glorify God in whatever situation you find yourself to be in. Even in the service of your master, you're actually serving Christ. That's what he said. Deal with it. Deal with the reality of the fact that the New Testament gospel goes out into a world where slavery is a reality. And it is not a message that says, rebel and start revolution right now. It just doesn't. You can pretend, you can do whatever, you can rightly say that scripture says you are not to steal people. And the black slavers in Africa that stole blacks from neighboring tribes and sold them, the vast majority going to the West Indies and to what we would call the Caribbean today, not to the United States, but they did come there. That was sinful. Paying money for that, sinful. No two ways about it. No question about it. But don't be like the atheist who sits here in the 21st century and completely ignores the reality of what was going on back then and say, I could write a better book in the Bible. And in doing so, what you're doing is you are condemning all these people to death by starvation. That's what you're doing. He just made the Bible a better book by ignoring the fact that it's had to exist for over 3,000 years. And the world is not the same today as it was 3,000 years ago. So since things have changed since then we need to look at what the contexts were and make proper application from there, which is what led to the abolitionist movement and things like that. But that takes time. And it's so simplistic to go, oh, you should just automatically know. You should just automatically know. Well, then what do you do with Philemon? What do you do with 1st and 2nd Timothy? What do you do with Titus? What do you do with Ephesians? They just should have known. No, you're wrong. You are trying to turn the Bible into a 21st century document with 21st century tastes and predilections, rather than recognizing that this revelation has been used by God and that every generation has to make application, and that it is amazing that we can do so, and we can do so by looking at the context and by understanding what happened in the past, where we are now, and that there are laws of general equity that we can apply and that we can understand in our day. And so when I hear Matt Dillahunty saying, I can write a better book, he's just ignorant of history. It's just a surface-level response. But let's be honest, how many Christian apologists are even going to push back? They're just going to accept the idea. Well, yeah, and you know how we deal with the Old Testament. And again, I understand the time pressure. I get it. You're on a program. I can say this with absolute honesty. I've been in the same studio. Okay, I haven't been on, this is the big discussions. That was actually videotaped. So I haven't done that, but how many times have I been on Unbelievable? I understand. And Justin will tell you, and I think Justin would agree if someone asked him this. Does James White work with you when it comes to keeping a program moving, time, getting things done? And Justin will say, yes, because I've done radio for most of my life. And so I fully understand time constraints, all the rest of that kind of stuff. So I get it. And I might have to very, 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 very briefly say something, but I would try to say something. I would want to push back instead of just going, well, you know, how you deal with the Old Testament, that's a tough issue. Would that, a lot of people would say, no, that you can't do it. But the fact is, the atheist can read the Bible just like I can. And they can go to the same text that I go to and say, hey, the New Testament has exhortations to those who own slaves and to those who are slaves. So I could make it better. Well, you could make it a document that would require the destruction of the Roman Empire for the gospel to go out. But that's not making the Bible better. That's showing a fundamental ignorance of how the Bible has functioned down through history, all the way back to its inception, all the way back to, I would say, personally, 1,400 years before the birth of Christ. So that's what I'm saying when I say, what, you know, how many, and I don't know what Glenn Scrivener's background is, and again, I think he did a good job. We're contrasting this not by means of trying to say I could have done better. I would have handled it differently in certain places. The emphases would have been different. Would that have resulted in different objections from Matt Dillahunty? Maybe. I don't know. But by providing the contrast, you and the audience have to sit back and go, huh, okay, well, where do I come down on that? Because there's some of you sitting in the audience that go, well, I hear what he's saying, but I will never agree with anything this guy says as long as he's wearing one of those sweaters. You know? And if that's what you think, then great. But as I've said in many of my classes for a long, long time, you may disagree with what I have to say. I'm just going to force you to understand why you disagree and to think through the foundations of why you would reject what it is I have to say. So that's the important part. All right. So with that, looking forward very much to seeing everybody at G3. Please remember, today is the 14th. We only have just right at 2 weeks until the costs increase on the trip to Rome, Israel. Remember that the Rome part is technically separate from the rest of it. I mean, you have to get to Rome because that's where the cruise starts. But those trips, or the day trips we're going to be doing there in Rome, Colosseum, Vatican, places like that around the ancient city, is a separate issue from specifically. So if you've signed, in other words, if you sign up for the cruise, that doesn't mean you're signing up for that part, because we got a lot of people that are just going to be coming in just to do the cruise. They can't do the other part because just too much time. I get it. Fully understand. But all that stuff, click on the link. There is a phone number you can call at Sovereign, and you talk to Kathy and to Ryan and to Stuart and whoever it is you end up talking to there. And they will be able to help you out with that as well. So, Lord willing, next week after G3, we'll see you here on the program. God bless.